including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country. International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
A cry for help for France's more than 3 million Muslims. A letter of complaint signed by a global coalition of 25 civil society organizations and NGOs spanning 11 countries to the President of the European Commission, urging immediate action against France for what they call is its state-sponsored Islamophobia. Renamed the Charter of Principles, the Imam Charter's 10 articles set out the so-called Republican values to which all imams in France should subscribe. Either you're with the Republic, the French president has warned, or you're not with the Republic.
What Macron is trying to do is feed into a narrative that Muslims is a cultural threat to France. And really, the reality is that France, the vast majority of French Muslims are law-abiding citizens. They've been arising social, economically in French society, and that is a concern and a threat to the French elite.
The new letter of complaint follows a similar one in January by a coalition of Muslim NGOs to the UN Human Rights Council. The already existing problem of French Islamophobia took a turn for the worse in the wake of the beheading of school teacher Samuel Paty by a Takfiri extremist outside his school in November last year for showing offensive cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during his class. For the French president, that provided a valuable opportunity. He defended the profane cartoons and introduced legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism.
So this is entirely cynical. He's using this for political gain. And the reality is, as soon as you start conceding room to the far right, then that normalizes them. So I wouldn't be surprised if he actually loses votes.
The deeply offensive caricatures set off angry protests worldwide. But inside France, a crackdown on the Muslim community. Multiple mosques were forced to close. The country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization were banned. Dozens of people were arrested, and hundreds faced deportation. Critics say the recent moves by the French state target Muslims and alienates them, and the French government's attempt at aligning French Islam with Republican values and to combat separatism raises more questions than answers. Said Kuriza, London.
The U.S. and South Korea began joint command post exercises Monday, which plan to run through March 18th. The controversial drills draw opposition from peace groups in South Korea and around the world. COVID-19 restrictions prevented more people from gathering outside the South Korean presidential office. But they made their point.
We have to pay attention to the U.S. emphasis on fight tonight, which means South Korea and the U.S. military training is to maintain combat readiness. We must think again on this point of combat readiness. What is the purpose of fight tonight? Who is it going to protect?
Activists in Seoul don't think the drills offer South Koreans protection.
We oppose the drill because it's not for the protection of the South Korea, but it's illegal training for the protection of the U.S. mainland and U.S. military bases in the Indo-Pacific area.
South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the drills would be scaled back. Quote, comprehensively taking into consideration the COVID-19 situation, the maintenance of the combat readiness posture, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and the establishment of peace. But some experts expect some type of provocation from North Korea in response to the exercises, as Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. U.S. President Joseph Biden's new administration has said it's reviewing its policy toward North Korea in consultation with its allies. Just as the U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to wrap up, sources say U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin will arrive here in Seoul for talks with their South Korean counterparts. North Korea policy should figure high on the agenda for those conversations. Frank Smith, Seoul.
All over France, demonstrations took place on the 8th of March, the International Women's Day. In hospitals, supermarkets, schools, and nurseries, most of the employees are women. The COVID-related lockdowns and curfews had a huge impact on them. Their working conditions are getting worse. A group of cleaning women working for a huge hotel chain in Paris are in strike for almost 2 years. The COVID does not improve their situation.
Because of the COVID, the boss said he would pay us, but he did not pay us at all. He said, because of the COVID, I cannot pay you. So in fact, the COVID has become a pretext for making profit on the back of the workers. The COVID arrived on a bad moment. I believe it benefits much more to the bosses and not at us, the workers.
According to a 2020 report of INSEE, the French National Institute for Statistics, women in France are paid 23% less than men. In many sectors, such as healthcare, retail, and cleanup, the work had to be maintained during the lockdown. And 8 over 10 employees in these sectors are women.
The COVID led to an overload of work because they have to clean door handles, for example, what they did not have to do before. Housemaids also go from one working place to another, which increases the possibility of contamination. But they continue assuring the work very seriously. We do not understand that their salaries are not increased.
The INSEE report also shows that the sectors where mostly women work were the most requested during the COVID crisis. The employees there had to work much more hours, and they had a high incidence of illnesses directly related to their working conditions.
The working conditions were already catastrophic before the COVID crisis, and it's getting worse. The French policies have not changed. They continue to diminish the number of hospital beds.
And if this was already not enough, it is also proven that the COVID crisis has increased the domestic violence against women.
Many women are fighting in the front line against the COVID pandemic, at work and at home. These protesters are demanding better and direct measures from the French government. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Hundreds of medical workers have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get 1 because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers.
Blocking oil vessels from entering the country threatens to stop many health facilities. There are more than 1,500 health centers and 400 laboratories and blood banks on the verge of closure. Centers that generate oxygen may also stop. The lives of patients may end within days. Patients with kidney problems are the most affected. There are more than 5,000 patients who need dialysis several times a week.
The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
All about turning innovative ideas into practice. Toward Stars is the title of this exhibition, which puts on display the latest technologies that are made in Iran. A whole range of high-tech products, from mapping drones to smart medical equipment, are showcased here. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, hailed the Iranian tech companies for helping to keep the national industries afloat amid foreign pressures.
In spite of the unilateral sanctions on our country, we have been able to serve our needs by tapping into our domestic resources and young minds. Technological development builds power and makes us independent from foreign powers. When a nation is independent, no other country can exert pressure on it.
The event was inspired by remarks made by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in August last year, where he put emphasis on the need to focus on science-based production and avoid exporting raw material and bulk goods, such as saffron. Given the fact that Iran produces 90% of the world's saffron, this Iranian producer has launched the so-called OSEC. It might sound music to the ears, since it rhymes with OPEC. Only the letter S stands for saffron. The Organization of Saffron Exporting Countries now is an established entity comprising 10 member states, with the goal to organize the global market.
The idea to set up the OSEC was driven by the fact that Iran, which has OSEC, is the hub of saffron production. But when it comes to exports, we are lagging behind. So OSEC seeks to organize the global market, not only for saffron, but with regards to caraway and caviar.
Well, there's a growing focus in Iran on commercializing indigenous products. This medical firm says the issue of marketing is still an alien word when it comes to Iranian-made products. But it says that's what it does.
Our company offers medical services in Iraq, Indonesia, and Afghanistan using Iranian-made equipment like hemodialysis systems and central water purification systems. In fact, we do the marketing job for Iranian manufacturers of medical equipment and offer the related services for our clients. We are working to find clients in more countries.
Iran has recently been trying to make a shift from an oil-based economy to other sources of income. The major drive behind such a move is to shield the economy from the ups and downs of oil prices. In recent years, such a shift is more vital, since Iran's crude sales have slashed as a result of U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran. This event comes as Iran is already rewiring its economy based on domestic production. This is significant given the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iran have denied the country access to foreign trade. But Tehran regards the restrictions as a blessing in disguise, saying self-sufficiency is the fruit of sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Debate.
Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Kovit Takwey. When it comes to the Iran nuclear deal, the lines have become blurred as what is exactly going on, but not for Iran. Even though there have been news or talks between Iran and the U.S. or step-for-step process towards the lifting of sanctions, Iran has not wavered from its original stance. All sanctions need to be lifted before Iran returns to the negotiating table. Now, will the U.S. make the fatal mistake of not returning to the deal and pursue the military path? Stay tuned to The Debate.
Iran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff over the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The U.S. says Iran must take the first step and return to full compliance with the deal. But Tehran says Washington must do so because former President Donald Trump unilaterally walked away from the accord in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
Iran, which began scaling down its JCPOA commitments 1 year after Washington's withdrawal, says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the accord and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. On Wednesday, top Iranian security sources ruled out a step-by-step return to the deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the U.S. only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. Speaking to Press TV, they also stressed that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader during a speech last month. Ayatollah Khamenei also said during his February speech that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure over its nuclear program and could enrich uranium up to 60% purity if the country needed it. He, however, reiterated that the Islamic Republic will never seek nukes. Now, as Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse the course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
For our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Said Mostafa Khoshchesh, who's a political analyst who joins us from Tehran. Said Mostafa Khoshchesh, welcome. Lots of news on the Iran nuclear deal, no surprise there. However, many of it is either fake news or it's just propaganda. So let me first ask you about how people are assuming that there are talks going on between the U.S. and Iran. And of course, the question, are there talks going on between the two?
Hello, Khabar, and thanks for having me. Well, just mentioned before the package, the report was displayed, you mentioned something about the military option. There is no path between the nuclear deal and the military option. As a matter of fact, if military option was a choice, they would have attacked Iran more than 15 years ago when they attacked Afghanistan and Iraq, and later the Pentagon plans leaked years later to the media revealed that they meant to push seven countries into chaos and disorder, including Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan through the military option, and they did it to all those six countries, but Iran was never among those because Iran had already worked the deterrent power. So they went for, they were forced to go for a lengthier way to do it, not in a single step, but in multiple steps. That includes first containing Iran's power, and then after they could, if they ever could, if they ever proved to be able to contain Iran, then weaken Iran, and then they might go for the military option. And Tehran is in the know, they know it pretty well, and that's why they have developed their deterrent, military deterrent power. Though There is no secret about this very fact that they've been speaking about the military threat as an option. That doesn't mean military action. That's just part of the United States containment strategy. This containment strategy, which came after they realized that they cannot attack Iran, worked through the carrot and stick policy. On the carrot side, they claim that they are, and they try to convince Iran that they are up for a conflict resolution, and they are up for talks, and they want to end their animosity and the animosity between the two sides, that they want peace and stability in the region. But if you take a look at the multiple agreements between Iran and the United States and the three European states in the past two decades, you would see that Iran has always been in compliance with the terms of the deals that it has struck with these powers. And even in the words of U.S. experts and officials, because Iranian officials believe that they are pursuing the path toward conflict resolution. But the Americans and the Europeans have never been after a conflict resolution. They have never been loyal to the deals that they have struck with Iran, because they never intended to resolve the conflicts with Iran over its nuclear industry or any other thing. They wanted a containment to weaken Iran in order to push back Iran, which has grown so powerful that has become a role model for other regional nations, that most of which happen to be under the U.S. hegemonic rule, and could endanger the U.S. interests in the region. So on the carrot side, they have always done this, but they have never been after a conflict resolution. On the stick side, I try to wrap it up. On the stick side, they've worked on two main pillars of sanctions, and posing credible military threat that I just explained would never end up in action. It's just posed in order to change the calculation among Iranian officials and people, especially in election season, and when they want and when they talk about JCPOA nuclear talks with the United States, so on and so forth. The sanctions are a weapon of choice for the United States. The sanctions regime carries most of the burden in this formula of containment, the strategy of containment. That's why they play tricks in order to keep the sanctions. Even Obama, that signed the nuclear deal with Iran, he signed removal of the sanctions, nuclear-related sanctions, but he never did that because they feel that they need the sanctions for the next steps. First step is the nuclear deal, and the nuclear deal is not everything. They need to work out other agreements in order to contain Iran's power, and they need the sanctions tool in this strategy.
Okay, well, let me bring in Michael Springman. He is an author and former diplomat from Washington, D.C., who joins us. You know, we've heard about this carrot and stick approach. It's been used, I don't know, maybe decades now at this point, as far back as my memory goes. Why not, in this case, in point, Michael Springman, forget about the carrot and go for another fruit called the lifting of sanctions? I mean, that's where we were at back in 2015 or 14. And
that's right.
If the U.S. does that, from Iran's foreign minister to Iran's leader to you name it, have said, if the U.S. does that, we return to the talks. And it doesn't even have to require a vote of any kind, according to the Iranian foreign minister. Why doesn't the U.S. do that?
Because the United States has opposed Iran since the 1953 with the overthrow of Mossadegh by the CIA and the British Secret Intelligence Service. They then pressed the Iranians after the repulsive Shah was overthrown in 1979, and the United States has looked for ways to control Iran and to ensure that American willpower and American politics and American foreign policy prevail in the region. They, of course, are influenced by that apartheid entity that sells itself Israel. I have no real insight into the Iranian government, and I probably shouldn't have, and shouldn't dictate things to what the Iranians do. But I would think that if the United States simply cannot cancel its sanctions, which it imposed unilaterally, maybe the Iranians could say, well, let's look for a new way of doing things, and we'll talk about a new agreement, provided we include Israel and Israel's atomic bombs Israel's poison gas, and Israel's a deadly bacteria. Let's have inspections there. Let's have an international body to administer this inspection and to limit the amount of these weapons that the Israelis can possess. So I think that the Americans talk and talk and talk, and they've got this news media that is tame and follows the lead of the American government because they want to keep their connections, because they want to keep their advertisers, and therefore they parrot what the government tells them to parrot. And this is the whole problem. It's a simple thing. They impose the sanctions with a stroke of a pen, and they can remove them with the stroke of a pen, but they don't want to do it because they simply want to destroy Iran and the Iranian people and the Iranian form of government.
Okay. Moving on, Mostafa Hoshesh, to this idea of step-by-step. This has been rotating in the news, a step-by-step move, something which Iran at this point has rejected outright. For the ones who are asking, why is this being rejected by Iran, what can you tell them?
A very good question. To put it in a nutshell, most of the debates these days is about the same fact. Let me put it this way, that could be understood easily for everyone. As I just explained, the United States is not up for, it doesn't want a conflict resolution over Iran's, for example, nuclear industry. They don't have any concerns about that. Otherwise, they would have stuck to the nuclear deal that provides them with the harshest ever imposed regime of inspections on any nation. So that explains why they have never been happy when the nuclear deal was struck. They were never satisfied with that, and they are asking for more. So to do more, they need their weapon of choice, the sanctions. Well, at the beginning, in 2015, Obama did it in a deceitful move. He signed removal of the nuclear-related sanctions, but they never did it in practice. So Iran couldn't do SWIFT, Iranian Central Bank couldn't do anything. So he was accused of lying by many, even the camp in Iran that's pro-talks, the negotiators, they all stressed years after that Obama never put it in action. He never removed the sanctions in practice. Now Washington knows, it's a long time they know that Iran has learned the game, and it would not be convinced to go for, you know, deals so easily. So they have worked out a different mechanism for the very same deceitful purpose. What have they done? After the U.S. exit of the nuclear deal, they went for an FSW rule that is fortifying sanctions wall. In other words, they copy-pasted the nuclear-related secondary sanctions under a different label, this time, for example, terrorism. Then again, for a third layer, they copy-pasted the same nuclear-related sanctions under a different label. That's called the regional practice of Iran and human rights and other layers. Of several layers, they have set this wall, they've thickened this wall in different layers. Why? Because they knew that now that Tehran has learned the game and cannot be deceived through the Obama way, if one day they are forced, because they are forced to keep the JCPOA and they know it, the military option is not an option, so their only way is building up on this JCPOA for containing other power components of Iran. So if one day they are forced to remove the nuclear-related sanctions, and they do it even in practice, really, again, the Iranian central bank and economy cannot do a single SWIFT, a single transaction. Why? Because identical regime of sanctions is still in place under a different label called terrorism. Even if Iran struck terrorism or whatever deal with them, and if Washington really removes the terrorism-related sanctions, again, the Iranian Central Bank cannot do anything because it's under similar, identical regime of sanctions under human rights, under its regional role, and so on and so forth. So they have worked out a mechanism in order to deceive Iran. This is in total breach of the nuclear deal contents, paragraphs 25, 26, mentions that you may not remove the nuclear-related sanctions and reimpose them under a different label or pretext. So what Iran wants, Iran knows this game, and it knows that they want to fool Tehran. So Tehran says, okay, you need to remove all the sanctions. I need to verify and see if you are honest or not, because you have always proved to be dishonest. And we know that Washington wants reciprocal moves, because they do not want us to see the end of the game, because they want to say, okay, we do remove just one part, you go for another part. After six, seven, eight phases, you would see that, okay, nuclear-related sanctions maximum has been have been removed, but still the Iranian central bank and Iranian economy is in trouble and cannot do anything. So what they need to do is remove all the sanctions, and Iran should be able to verify it. Otherwise, Tehran will not be fooled at all.
Okay. Michael Springman, I'm sure you've heard of what has hit the news pretty heavily, and I'm going to bring up the name Richard Nephew and ask you about the actions taken by this man who was chosen as Biden's deputy on Iran's file now, and how he has come out in the news taking personal credit for depriving Iranians of food and driving up the unemployment rate in the country, celebrating the economic destruction that he caused as what he called a tremendous success, in which it is said now that he will be helping direct that policy on Iran now with Biden's appointment. Is this a revelation of the true nature of the U.S., that it wants Iranians to suffer?
Yes, indeed. The people that Biden has appointed, like this Nephew fellow and others, are people that have nothing but contempt for the rest of the world, and in particular Iran. You've got this Neera Tanden that Biden wanted to appoint as the director of the budget, and she wanted to have Libya paid for being bombed and to turn its oil over to the United States to pay for the cost of the illegal and unconstitutional war against the country. So this is typical of the American attitude. And Nephew isn't the only one. You've got Blinken, the Secretary of State, who is a Jew and conceivably a Zionist, talking about how Iran continually has to comply with American demands, and step by step, tit for tat, we will get around to lifting the sanctions if Iran starts to do things that we want Iran to do and not what Iran itself wants to do. The American government has tried for decades to destroy the country. I've been there, and it's a wonderful country, filled with very helpful, very pleasant people. And granted, it was 3 years ago, but it was still functioning then. There were tremendous traffic jams. There were goods in the shops. And I got some fantastic meals and met some really marvelous people, like Nader Talibzadeh. And this is what the Americans don't want the world to know. This is what the Americans want to crush and destroy, because it gives a lie to their statements publicly and privately about the evils of Iran and how Iran is a terrorist state, when it fails to look at itself as a terrorist state, when it fails to look at the apartheid entity of Israel as a terrorist state, or Saudi Arabia as a terrorist state, and the Gulf Cooperation Council, which it set up with all those repressive and repulsive medieval monarchies on the Red Sea there. So it's, yes, the Nephew is the true face of American policy towards Iran.
Okay. My final question to you, Mostafa Khoshesh. This was quite a telling scene when the picture came out of how it showed you have Israeli jets escorting U.S. B-52 bombers, which carry nuclear weapons, amid the tensions that are going on, and of course the possibilities of Iran and the U.S. maybe working out something. I mean, first of all, what signal does that send, and what impression is Iran supposed to get, who's pursuing a civilian nuclear program but is being sent a message by a U.S. B-52 bomber that carries nuclear weapons?
Kaveh, in this formula of containment, half of the job is done through posing credible military threat without any action, as I said. It's a professional poker player bluff, actually. If there was any doubt among Iranians, they realized it last year after triple incidents in the Persian Gulf, after the shooting down of the U.S. Global Harbor Triton, as well as the Iranian missile strike on Ain al-Assad, which when Donald Trump had already warned that he would reciprocate it with bombing 52 cultural centers in Iran, a very vivid and strong threat. But he never did any action. He was the U.S. president. He was a warmonger, but he never took any action. It was proved that the U.S. military threats are not credible. But still, they insist on that. They would not give it up. So they are trying to project Israel as a complementary threat. That's why their media, the Israeli media, American media, are filled with so many lies about sabotage, bombing Iranians in Syria and elsewhere. Yes, they did the sabotage at Natanz. They assassinated Dr. Fakhrizadeh. True, they would receive a harsh revenge, as Iran has already promised. But they are too weak to claim so many attacks that all have proved to be lies.
Right.
Because they very much calculate on posing threat to the Iranian public. They believe that if they pose a serious threat, the Israelis and Americans, then they can change the minds of Iranian officials and their calculations, as well as the Iranian public in the election season.
Okay.
So Tehran believes that Israel is too shaky to represent any kind of threat, but still, military is the military, and they would not ignore any kind of threat. So the Israeli officials like Netanyahu, they need to watch the words.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're unfortunately out of time. Thank you very much, Said Mustafa Fashesh, political analyst, and thank you very much, Michael Springman, author and political former diplomat, that is, from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, my entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Massive wildfires have shattered records across the world in recent years, including in the western United States, where deadly blazes forced mass evacuations in 2020 and filled the sky across entire regions with smoke, says Mike Ludwig Ryder in an article published under the heading, Wildfires Will Keep Getting Worse, Even in Best-Case Climate Scenarios. Stay tuned for more. Wildfires have shattered records across the world in recent years, including in the western United States, where deadly blazes forced mass evacuations in 2020 and filled the sky across entire regions with smoke. Globally, wildfires are becoming more frequent, destructive, and burning more land, and this trend is set to continue. Even under a best-case scenario where greenhouse gas emissions are rapidly reduced in the coming decades and global warming is limited to 2 degrees Celsius, climate change will still drastically increase the size and likelihood of destructive wildfires globally, according to a new international study published in Environmental Research Letters. It's essential to reduce warming as much as possible to avert wildfire catastrophes, according to the study's authors. Limiting warming further by even half a degree to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the rosiest of climate projections, would substantially reduce the danger of fire across the most populated continents, including in the African Sahara as well as the Amazon rainforest, which saw alarming outbreaks of forest fire in 2019 and 2020. Climate disruption contributes to heat waves, droughts, and other factors that create prime conditions for wildfires and lengthen regional fire seasons, including fueling a dangerous feedback loop as fires put more carbon dioxide into the air. Under the Paris Climate Accord, countries around the world agreed to pursue efforts to limit global warming to between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. These numbers are based on projections of what the world will look like over the course of a generation as temperatures rise. However, since the international goalposts were announced in 2015, scientists have warned that these best-case targets are probably not achievable. To achieve an increase of only 1.5 degrees by 2100, carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions must be rapidly reduced in the coming decades and brought to net zero by 2050. Under the current climate policies in place in the U.S. and across the world, the Earth is projected to warm by about 2.9 degrees by 2100, according to the Climate Action Tracker, which compares climate action across governments to the goals set by the Paris Agreement. Without any climate action, temperatures would warm by more than 4 degrees by the end of the century, causing up to 2 meters of sea level rise globally. Most of the research on climate and wildfires focuses on more extreme emission scenarios, and a team of scientists from South Korea, Japan,
and the U.S. wanted to know if wildfires would get worse even if humans achieve most ambitious climate goals. Using 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius in warming as benchmarks, the team projected various fire weather conditions such as temperature, humidity, and wind speed, and concluded that fire-prone weather conditions will be more extreme in the future regardless of the degree of warming, although, of course, fires would likely be worse and more prevalent under the highest warming scenarios. Although it is reasonable to look at fire weather under more extreme circumstances, there is little sense in making goals without a good understanding of what might happen if you were to reach those goals, said co-author Seung-hee Kim of Chapman University in a statement. So we ask, what would happen if we did reach these goals? Would the fire weather conditions not become as severe? The answer to this question is complicated, but the connection between wildfires and climate change is clear. In the western U.S., for example, researchers have found human-caused climate change caused hotter, drier conditions that doubled the number of acres of land and forest burned since mid-1980s. The number of dry, hot, and windy autumn days that are perfect weather for fires has doubled in California, which saw its worst fire season on record last year. Climate change has extended the annual fire season in the U.S. by an average of 78 days since 1970, draining firefighting resources at both the state and federal levels. Working with Gwangju Institute of Science and Technology in South Korea, Kim's team did find a silver lining in their research. By comparing fire weather projections based on 1.5 and 2 degrees of warming, the scientists determined that limiting warming by even half a degree could substantially reduce fire risk, especially in high-danger areas such as the Amazon rainforest, African savannas, and much of the Mediterranean. The researchers concluded that warming temperatures remain a principal factor behind increased fire risk, although the impact of human land use decision requires further study. If we were somehow able to suppress this extra half a degree of warming, we could reduce climate-driven extreme fire activities in many places, potentially saving many lives and billions of dollars, said co-author Simon Wong of Utah State University. However, Wong said countries such as Australia and Indonesia will likely face peak levels of fire susceptibility before global average temperatures increase by 1.5 degrees Celsius, putting those areas at risk for more extreme fire seasons in years to come. Despite denialism among conservative politicians, warming temperatures in the U.S. have already contributed to record-breaking fire seasons as forests continue to die from a variety of climate-related stressors, with five of the six largest wildfires in California's history erupting in 2020 alone. The wildfire research is just the latest evidence that a world unchanged by the climate crisis has already disappeared in the rearview mirror. At this point, the actions governments and economies take over the next few decades can only determine how much worse it will get.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English.